Welcome to the Explore Words, Discover Worlds podcast, presented by Bradford Literature Festival. In this episode, discover how as part of the 1904 Great Exhibition in Lister Park, 60 Somali individuals, including men, women and children, resided in a walled compound for 6 months as an exhibit. Recorded live at the 2024 Bradford Literature Festival, Fozia Bora tells the stories of some of the villagers who speak from the past through the recovery of written, oral and photographic archives.
Hi everyone. Thank you very much for coming, for the gift of your time and your presence. It's a pleasure to be here as part of the wonderful Bradford Literature Festival. So my talk today is in some sense a follow-on from a talk on Tuesday, which some of you may have attended, by my colleague Christopher Gaffney from the University of Bradford, which mentioned and kind of explored the 1904 Great Exhibition of Bradford. How many of you here have heard of this exhibition? Good, a good many of you. This was an industrial exhibition that took place over 6 months in the year 1904 as a way to show off Bradford's industrial prowess. But it also had many other items on display. So today we'll be speaking about one of those things on display, which was a colonial village, a Somali village. Part of the work I've been doing on this village, I'm based at the University of Leeds. I'm in the School of Languages, Cultures and Societies. I'm a historian of Muslim communities and Islamic history. And part of the exploration of this particular history is to bring together a team of archaeologists, Somali experts, including Somali historians, linguists and artists, and also historians like myself. We also have archival experts who are part of the project. So my talk today will cover the history of the village, what was it doing there, who was involved, but also how we are going to retell the story of this village, which it's safe to say not many people have heard about. I would love to be proved wrong. If any of you know something about the village, I would love to know more. Okay, so the title of the presentation is A Somali Village in Colonial Bradford, a local and global forgotten history. The local and the global really come together in the story of this Somali village. The colonial identity of Bradford is very important to the story. It's a familiar story in some ways because we know that migration, even though this was temporary migration, but migration is a story of we are here because you were there. In other words, why do we have a multicultural city like Bradford? It's part of the colonial aftermath or afterlives. Okay, so the Somali village is a story of what happened in colonial Bradford and industrial Bradford. I'm going to begin with a somber photo of a grave, and it's a poignant moment. This grave marks the resting place of a Somali woman called Halimo Abdi Bedell. She was 26 years old when she died in Bradford. Her story is central to the story of the Somali village, and I'll say more about her in a minute. But the headstone was erected in 2004 due to two researchers from Bradford Museums and Galleries looking into the history of the Great Exhibition, and they found references to a death in the Somali village. And so they went to the cemetery, looked into the archives, and discovered an unmarked spot where Halima was buried. So they made sure that she got a proper headstone, and the Muslim registrar of the cemetery did prayers over her grave. And Halima's story is where we begin. Who was she? Why was she in Bradford, away from her homeland? And there's a story here. You can pick up the story. If you go for Google Telegraph and Argos Somali Village, you'll see the story of how Halimo's grave was found 100 years after her passing. So let's rewind a bit. When the imperial exhibitions took place around the UK, but also across Europe and North America, part of the purpose of these exhibitions was to showcase technology, industrial machinery, medical advances, and so forth. But there were also cultural offerings. cultural in the sense of people in the UK wanting to know what life was like in other parts of the world, other parts of the world that they would likely never visit. And so it became common practice to bring exotic displays into British cities. Part of that kind of, well, the kind of story of these exotic displays is a longer story, which I won't go into here. It began with Carl Hagenbeck, a German impresario, would bring exotic animals, and then that evolved into people shows. Now, this brings me to an important question. Should we describe these villages as human zoos? I would say that not, because these were not people just being looked at. These were individuals who came to European cities because they wanted to do business. They were contracted, okay? They were paid. They came voluntarily. They did put on a performance, and there's no doubt they were exploited, because if you look at what they were paid, it was small amounts. Relative to the sacrifices they make to cross continents and oceans to be in these villages, they should have been paid a lot better. Nevertheless, these are not correctly called human zoos. These were individuals with extremely rich, interesting lives, often highly educated, highly multilingual, and very good business people. And that will come out when we pursue the story a bit further. So this is an image of a group of Somalis coming to London in 1895. And we wonder whether Halimo, the young lady who passed away at the age of 26 in Bradford, is in this photo. We don't actually have a photo of Halimo, which we'll come back to in a minute as to why we don't have her picture. But we do see here a range of Somalis of different ages, men, women, children, with a few Europeans, which could be their handlers, impresarios, or they could be fellow travelers just who happen to be in the picture. We don't have all of the details. The archives tell us some broad brush strokes, but often the detail is hard to find. So that's just a speculative question. Is Halimo in this picture? If so, it would be the only photo we have of her. So to set the scene, the imperial villages, including the one in Bradford, had several functions. We heard a wonderful account of it from Christopher Gaffney on Tuesday. But to kind of build on what he said, or to even kind of reiterate what he was outlining to us, the purpose of these villages was partly educational, partly trade fair, and partly entertainment. Entertainment was an important part of this experience to visit one of these exhibitions. The great parks of our cities were places where people could come and have a day out. And the idea was that you would visit the 1904 exhibition in Lister Park and learn a great deal in a short amount of time, a great deal about science and technology, a great deal about the empire. And what was interesting is that within these villages, you even had often an emigration bureau. And this underlines the colonial context. What was an emigration bureau? It was a place where the Bradford officials would try and encourage Bradfordians to visit the colonies and settle there. So you can see there's a whole kind of infrastructure as to how Bradford as a global city is working at this moment in time. So the Bradford exhibition was a great success. We know that 2.4 million people visited it, and that's in the larger context where we had villages occurring in European capitals from around 1850 to around 1950. That's as late as they go, you know, past the Second World War. It seems slightly shocking now that you had villages of this kind still occurring as late as 1950, but that's what happened. And they evolved a lot, you know. I've spoken about exotic animals and so on. That was the early iteration. In a sense, the most dehumanizing, where you had, you know, kind of exotic animals and then, you know, bringing people in with them. But then by the time we get to 1904 Bradford, it is quite a different kind of display. In terms of how many people came to these villages, looking at the trade as a whole, around 35,000 people. It's not a massive, massive number, given that they took place over a long time, but we do know that they made big impacts in the cities where the villages took place or were staged. And one of the interesting features of the 1904 exhibition is that there was no barrier between the villages and the people visiting. Why is that? It's because There was a need to show authenticity. This is not just a performance. This is not just someone on a stage performing their culture. These are real people and you can get up close and personal. Okay, so it was about trying to distinguish between performance and authenticity. And some of the photos show that the lack of a barrier between audience and villagers gives us very interesting intimacy almost between them, even though it's a story of people being looked at and people doing the looking. I'm going to quickly say a few words about a bit more about the global background. We know, to kind of put into context why Somalis came to these kinds of displays. So in 1869, the opening of the Suez Canal, which for the first time opens up the route between the Red Sea and the Mediterranean. It's very important for the British Empire and for the Western empires generally, European empires generally. In the shipping that passes through the Suez Canal, there's a need for sailors. Somalis are part of the group, many of the groups that sign up to become sailors. They want to come to Britain also and work in the docks. Okay, this is a way to earn some extra money, buy more livestock at home, and be upwardly mobile. Okay, so there's a business opportunity or an employment opportunity. So that's one way in which you see Somalis traveling to Western countries. There's also an important feature of Somali life, which is a nomadic way of life. So they are, in general, great travelers. And so in that sense, the idea of Somalis traveling to be part of ethnographic troops or display villages is not too surprising. So between 1817 and 1914, there was a scramble for Africa, where various European nations were keen to slice up the African nations or African regions and take a piece for themselves. That's another whole story. What happens in Somalia, and I'll skip over to another map just to put us in the picture. So all of this is kind of historical Somalia. Part of historical Somalia became British and Italian Somaliland, and then you had French Somaliland, which was Djibouti, present-day Djibouti. Okay, so this is really where our story takes place, the story of our Somali village. The Somalis that came to Bradford in 1904 were from this border region between Somaliland and Djibouti. Okay, and that becomes significant as we go on. Now, at the time that the Somalis came, and there were 57 of them, came to be part of this village. At this point in time, the British were conducting the Anglo-Somali Wars. So there's a real war happening on the ground in Somalia while the villagers are displaying their culture. This is interesting because when the Somalis come, and bear in mind that they're treated with a certain amount of affection by the Bradfordians, that the city officials make it clear that these Somalis are not connected with the insurgents, they're fighting against insurgents, you know. So, but nevertheless, the context is one of war and colonial campaigns and anti-colonial resistance on the part of Somalis. So this is a bit of a historical map showing the kind of the scramble for Africa kind of laid out in map form. So in the scramble for Africa, Somalis come to be recruited for various kinds of activity as seamen, but also as part of these ethnographic troops. Ethnographic meaning to display their culture, study of an ethnos or a people. And the Somali troops came to London, not the same troop, but various troops. We know of at least two main ones, there could have been more. They come to London in 1895, in 1905, in 1911, and in 1924. They come to Bradford in 1904, that's our village. They come to Dublin in 1907 and 1912, in Edinburgh 1910, and in Douglas on the Isle of Man in 1912 as well. Interestingly, these are all capital cities except Bradford. Yay for Bradford. It's up there. So this Somali troop comes from the Djibouti-Ethiopian border, and they are recruited by an impresario or showman called Victor Bamberger, who's a businessman. He wants to make money out of this village, but the Somalis also want to make money. Okay, they're not doing it for free. They're doing it because here is an opportunity to sell their crafts, the things they make, and an opportunity to travel. So there are various motivations involved. So Victor Bamberger, he is helped by the leader of the Somali village in Bradford, Sultan Ali al-Urfa, or Orfar, as the German archive calls him. And this group of 57 Somalis first come to, we think it's the same group, more or less the same group, first come to France, to Nice, spend a month there, go to Marseille, go on display for a month, and then they come to Bradford at the start of May 1904. Now, this same group did go on to travel further. They did go back home in between, but they do go on to Oldenburg in Germany for further displays. In fact, it's thought that they traveled for a further 10 years after their stay in Bradford in 1904. So you can see this is a way of life. In fact, the Somalis call people of the fair the Arwo. Okay, they have a term for people who take up this profession of going on travels and being part of these display villages. Interestingly, we've spoken to our Somali experts and collaborators and researchers, and for them, there isn't a stigma attached to doing this kind of work. People saw it as entrepreneurship. So that's important to remember when we think, when we look back on the archive and in some ways, the way in which this story has been hidden, partly out of a sense of shame. You know, there's a sense of shame around the idea that in a Bradford park, a village of Africans was displayed for 6 months. I mean, you can understand that, right? Where that sense of shame comes from. But there is another whole way of telling this story if we put Somalis at the center of the story, which is what we were trying to do with the project. So, a bit more about the Somalis in the exhibition. I'm not going to go over the wonderful ground covered by Chris, but we do know that the exhibition had music, sports, and its most profitable extra show, a sideshow, was the Somali village. It attracted almost 350,000 people. You bought a separate ticket for the Somali village, and it was a chance for people to come close and see how Somalis did weaving, blacksmithery, ritual prayers, teaching their children Arabic. So in other words, daily life, but also there would be performances, for example, reenactments of battle, for example, processions, for example, singing, chanting, dancing. So it's a mixture of authentic life and performance. In some of these photographs, which are taken from the archives, Graham Hall, a local photographer and postcard enthusiast, has provided a lot of these images. You can see glimpses of both staged action and non-staged action. And we'll come back to that, staged and non-staged, at the end, because at the very beginning of my first slide, I do have two juxtaposing images of a group of kids. One is more staged than the other, and we can do a little contrast if we get time at the end. So, the visitors that came to the Somali village were numerous, and if you look at how much revenue they generated, of all the sideshows, the Somali village was the most profitable. Okay, so here you see the relative profits created by the different sideshows, and Somali village is right up there, way above the water chute, the switchback railway, etc., etc., etc. And that's from the manager's report and statements of accounts of the exhibition in 1905. I'm just going to show you one map. We had a series of wonderful maps on Tuesday, so I'm just going to show you one map. This is taken from the West Yorkshire Archives catalogue, contemporary catalogue of the 1904 exhibition. And here you see where the village was located. So the village is this part here. So those of you who know Lister Park will recognise that this is Cartwright Hall. And then you have a series of temporary buildings put up for the purposes of this amazing and marvelous exhibition, and the Somali village was erected at this location. So there's the beautiful kind of arboretum area that you see today. There's the lake. And behind was the model railway, and the lake was just there. It's an interesting story of one of the Somali village ladies. Sometime in October, she jumped into the lake just for fun, and that caused a bit of an uproar. Okay, so that's where it was, and we've heard, you know, on Tuesday about all the different kinds of activities that were happening in the village. And the Somali village was just one of many. What's interesting was how prominent the village became in the press of the time and also in people's recollections. So the local press had this, for example, a series of sketches from the industrial exhibition. You probably can't see because it's quite a small screen. I'm sorry about that. But here you see scenes, sketches. A sectorial warping and beaming machine. Okay, some of Bradford's industrial prowess being displayed here. A model of a weaving machine, fantastic. Then you have Cartwright, the inventor of the power loom, whose statue is in Cartwright Hall. Lord Masham, who pays for Cartwright Hall, and this exhibition, of course, inaugurated Cartwright Hall. and the Somali village paid for its art collection, interestingly. But then you have a series of scenes from the Somali village, which the artist has captured. Here's a little boy asking for money. Why is he asking for money? Because if you took photographs of the Somali village, you had to pay extra. And that was part of the business operation. Okay? You have boys being trained in spear throwing, the arts of spear throwing. Now, is this real? Is it performance? Is it authentic? Who knows? This is where our Somali historians are going to give us some insights as we go along. Probably a mixture of both. Here you have a blacksmith with his bellows. They did real metalwork there. Part of the archaeological imprint is that we see there was stuff like that going on. And here is a saddler working with leather, and here's the village barber. The village had an imam, a mullah, a priest. It had a chief, the sultan. It had the mullah also was a kind of doctor. He would give remedies to those who needed it. He also dispensed justice and did arbitration if there was a dispute between villages. There's only 57 of them, but the whole dramas of everyday life came with them. Okay, so they needed all of these people to help maintain a sense of a community. When we look back, we find the story is not particularly well remembered. This changed in 2004 when the Cartwright Hall did produce a brochure to commemorate the exhibition as a whole, and part of that included some villages, some photographs and a bit of commentary on the village. What's interesting, though, is that we don't really get an understanding of who these people actually were. What were their names? Where did they come from? What were their life stories? What did they bring with them? And what did they take back with them when they returned to Somalia? Some of them didn't return immediately. Many traveled on further. So part of the project is to try and recover these stories. Now, here's an example of a photograph which shows that there was no barrier between the Somalis and the Bradfordians who came to visit them. These are prominent Bradfordians. This is from Graham Hall's collection. And it shows Lord Masham, prominent local dignitary, also known as Samuel Lister, and the former Lord Mayor and Chairman of the Exhibition's Executive Committee, Councillor William Lupton, inspecting the village. Okay, they're seeing the Somalis going about their everyday business. And it's uncomfortable, because here you see people doing stuff, and then other people watching them. Okay, it's a bit like Big Brother, but on a different kind of scale. So really, the point of our project now in this new phase is to recover the stories of the Somalis as a community and as individuals. So here I have a quotation from Asma Jama, a Somali poet, who's reflected on the archival photos of this village, of our village, but also other villages like it. She says, "It was hard to look at them, i.e. the Somalis, in these photos, knowing what had happened to them. It was hard to know that the person behind the lens would have been someone from colonial administration, systematically documenting my people. Occasionally something would be marked South Somali, and that would be it. The only indication of what I was looking at. This is all I had to piece together to form an understanding of my people's past. While the colonizers were given names, biographies, and obituaries, my ancestors, caught in these photographs, were unnamed and died without their stories." So the project that we're doing with the University of Bradford, with Bradford Museums and Galleries, with the University of Leeds, Everyday Muslim Archiving Organization, and Somali Heritage Organizations is to recover the stories of these 57 villages as best we can, using both the West Yorkshire Archive, but also going back to Somaliland, going back to Hargeisa, going back to Djibouti, going back to the places where we may have descendants of these Somalis, and to tap into their oral history. They have strong poetic traditions of commemorating history through poetry and genealogy. So the idea is that we recover this story and put their stories back on the map of Bradford's history, but also the history of Somaliland. So a bit about our team. So we have a number of Somalis in the collaborative community that we have. We have Musa Awale and a few others. They are experts on Somali heritage, but also on Somali art. So we have poet Yusra Warsama, who's a well-known actor. She's currently writing a poem her interpretation of this history, and she's going to share that in a documentary. So we're kind of excited about the next stage of trying to recover this history. Even though we accept and acknowledge that it's a troubling history and a traumatic history for many, we can't shy away from the fact that this is an uncomfortable space. But we hear loud and clear from the Somali community and our Somali partners that this is a story that must be told. So that's what we're trying to do. The West Yorkshire Archive has been our first port of call, and it includes the Yorkshire Press, so contemporary account, official records from the City Council and from Cartwright Hall, photographs official and unofficial. Also, the evidence coming from Europe, because this troop came from Marseille, went on to Oldenburg. There's quite a lot of trail of evidence that follows them. And so we're following that as we go along. And that's kind of part of our story. But the most important aspect at this stage is to recover the Somalis' own perceptions of this history. So in terms of what the evidence is so far, or kind of the bodies of evidence we have local press coverage and so on. And in that you see lovely snippets. For example, quotations from Sultan Ali, the leader of the troop. He is very funny. He shows how sometimes the Somalis are actually mocking the people who are looking at them. There's a lot of humor there. There's a lot of satire. And in that sense, they're nobody's victims, right? They know what they're doing. They're there with a purpose. They have their objectives. And if they see something bizarre and funny in the people looking at them, they are not afraid to point that out. There were certain events in those 6 months which were very dramatic. Okay. One of which was a fire. I'll come to that in a second. A burial, Halimo, the young lady we talked about at the beginning, and a picket, a protest, which we'll come to as well. And there was a birth, the birth of a baby, a baby called Khadija Yorkshire, named after her place of birth. Before I get to the events of the village, I haven't got very long, but I'll quickly talk a bit about how much they're paid. So the Somalis are paid £7 to £12 of profit for 6 months of work. It's not a lot of money, probably about £10,000. And then you have, less than a few thousand pounds. The Sultan Ali, the leader of the troop, he earned a bit more, as did the Imam. He earned £42,000, around £10,000. How did they make the money? By selling their handicrafts. And because of the money given to them when photographs were taken. We don't have any artifacts that we know of remaining from Bradford 1904 of the Somali village, but we do have a few that were found in Oldenburg when the same troop went to Germany the year after. Now, the villagers arrive in May. In August, a fire breaks out, the end of August. A fire breaks out, we don't quite know why. It could be an electrical wiring fault. It could be that the kids were given matches to play with. Someone in the compound complained that kids should not be given matches to play with. It could lead to a fire, and a fire did happen. We don't know the exact cause. The Somalis lost a lot of their handicrafts, their valuables. Four huts burnt down. Luckily, no people were harmed, but they lost a lot of property. They were supposedly covered by insurance, but the insurance didn't come through. The Somalis were left out of pocket. They only received a few pounds of compensation for some items of European dress, but all of their other items were not compensated. What did they do? They kind of sat on it for a while. On the last day of the exhibition, at the end of October, on the day they were supposed to be taken by train to Hull, from there to Rotterdam, from there to Aden, back home, they put on a picket. They protested at the town hall. They knew that the press would be there. They knew that this would be maximum exposure of their grievance. They also knew that this would be embarrassing for the city authorities to not give them the compensation they deserved. So although the picket failed and the Somalis did not receive the compensation, their claim was rejected, unfairly in my opinion. It shows that they took the business aspect of their time here really seriously. It was something that they pushed for and they saw as a business opportunity. Now, we do know the names of some of the Somalis of the village, which is really nice. How do we know the names? Because some of the children, for example, played cricket with locals and they took part in races. The response of the Bradfordian visitors included, yes, there were instances of racialization, but there were also affectionate responses to the village, and there were attempts by the organizers of the exhibition to show that the villagers were being treated well. In what way? I'll give you some examples. When Halima fell ill in May, she was sent a doctor, and she unfortunately passed away after 5 months. And in that time, she was confined to her hut because her disease was tuberculosis. It's thought she brought it with her. We don't know for sure. And when she passed away, this was a big deal. Because you can imagine how many visitors coming to the village, how prominent it is in the press. They wanted to make sure it did not cause any controversy. So she was given a very ceremonial burial with full Islamic rites. We don't have all the details, but the Yorkshire Press describe a highly dignified burial. Her funeral cortege was taken down Manningham Lane to Schoolmore Cemetery. And she was given last rites by an imam. Okay, and she is the first known Muslim burial in this city of many Muslim burials. So it's a very poignant story. A few days, 3 days after Halima's death, a baby was born in the village. And the press made a big deal of this. There was a 17-gun salute, and this was splashed across the Yorkshire press that a baby has been born. A princess, they called her, because she was supposedly the daughter of the Sultan and his wife, Fatima. Now, some commentators in our research group have said that in some ways, this was a positive good news story to compensate for the sad story of Halima's death. So more was made of it than perhaps was warranted. Was she even the Sultan's daughter? Who knows? But anyway, it was a very positive story at the time. And this young baby was called Khadija Yorkshire. I would love to know more about what happened to her when the village came to an end. And that's part of our kind of exploration, is to try to trace these individuals in their life beyond Bradford 1904. So I think my time is nearly up, but I would say that we want to uncover the stories of these wonderful individuals. Sultan Ali spoke 6 languages, for example. You know, we had a lot of knowledge in this community, a lot of know-how, a lot of expertise of their own. So our project includes sharing the story of the 1904 Somali village in different ways. So we have a poetic documentary being made at the moment by Yusra Warsama, a Somali artist and poet. We have a book of essays that we're working on, in which we're trying to capture some of the knowledge that the Somalis brought with them. They were building their own huts or aqal, portable homes. The technologies of that, you know, the knowledge of ecology, of botany, of climate and soil, all of that knowledge, how do we convey that today? And these knowledges have not died out. Okay, they brought them with them to Bradford in 1904. They developed them over the decades, and they still use these knowledge systems today. So we want to talk about that in our work. They also had strong traditions of poetry, as I mentioned before. We want to bring that into our project. We're going to have an e-zine or kind of extended blog post curated by young Somalis, looking back, reflecting back on this history and how it affects their identity as British Somalis today. And the ultimate goal is to have a travelling exhibition, which includes a story of Bradford's Somali village of 1904, but includes other Somali villages, and it will go from Bradford to London, to Germany, to the USA and to Canada. USA and Canada, there are actually museums of Somali history and heritage, so we're hoping to connect with these projects. In Germany, in Oldenburg, where our group of Somalis went the year later, they already had a wonderful exhibition. So we want to replicate that in Bradford and then move this exhibition elsewhere. Thank you very much for listening. So do we have any questions about the presentation?
Do we know if the village would have been a natural collection of people who you'd expect to find together, like families who are relatively close, cousins or friends from the same area? Or was it that whoever was collecting the village together sort of said, oh, we need a blacksmith, we need a family of four, we need people with... Do we know if they were sort of, well, synthetic or natural?
Yeah. So, excellent question. Thank you for that. So we're still trying to work that out. What we do know is that when Sultan Ali and people like him put together a troop, the people in the troop would change from one exhibition to another. So it was a kind of way of life. It was a profession of sorts. At the same time, clan loyalty, family groups would very likely have been part of it. We don't know enough about the biographies of individuals to know whether everybody in one village would have been connected to each other already. Of course, there were families in the village, and they're naturally already connected. But whether they came together for the purposes of the ethnographic display, or whether they were already connected, is a story that actually remains to be explored. From what I understand, the brokers, the Somali brokers that would put these villages or groups together, they would rely on personal networks. So it's likely that it wasn't just an open call, but rather, who do you know in your circles? Because these are very intimate relationships. You're traveling together, you're living together, you're doing business together. All of these things that could be potentially contentious if you didn't get along. There was one instance in our village of 1904 where there was a dispute. We don't know the nature of the dispute. And the normal route for resolving a dispute was through the imam's arbitration. And that didn't work. And a person was cautioned by the police, a villager, to not threaten the other villagers. But we don't know anything more than that. But that's an isolated incident amongst the 6 months of what seems like very harmonious life together. So my guess would be that it's a mixture of people coming in to take up the profession, but that relying on personal networks. So kind of somewhere in between. That's what we know. Any other questions?
Hi there. Thank you for that. That was really interesting. But I feel that you're probably over generous to the Victorians about the way in which they were treating the people in the village.
Yeah.
My sense of it, and I have heard the story before, was, I mean, at that time, if you think back, I mean, the Elephant Man and all sorts of other stories of the freak show was very commonplace.
Yeah.
And whilst I understand why you would want to impart dignity to the Somali villagers, I think probably the attitude of the Victorians wasn't quite as charitable as you make it out to be.
Yeah. No, I think you're right. I think the Victorians can be held up to be people who looked at the other peoples of the world through a racial lens, through a hierarchy of kind of, let's say, human behaviors, the civilized versus the uncivilized. That's absolutely there. But that's not the story I'm interested in. That's not the story that I think is that story is already there. The archive is clear about that. The postcards, the Yorkshire Press, they often show the racial lens through which the Somalis are viewed. But in a sense, we kind of know that, and we understand how problematic it is and how kind of ugly it is in some ways, that racialized perception. At the same time, that doesn't capture who the Somalis were. And I suppose our project is really recovering the story of the Somali village from the Somali point of view. Now, I say that the Victorians had a mixture of attitude. The whole setup is highly unequal. It's highly asymmetric. It's highly exploitative. There's no doubt. And I don't want to pretend that didn't happen. We don't want to do that in the project. But it's really about, as Asma Jama said, if we focus too much on that, we're not reversing the colonial lens. And really what we're doing is we're allowing the Somalis to speak back through the archive, speak back, find their voices, find their agency, find their stories. And I think that's what's the purpose of the project now. Does that make sense?
It does, but I mean, my view is that they had the dignity and we didn't actually understand that they had dignity. And I understand why you would want to portray the positive.
Yeah.
And okay, fine, but I think it was our problem that we didn't show. I mean, at the time, as I recall, Somalia was being invaded not only by the British and, well, the Italians eventually took it over, didn't they?
Yeah.
Yeah, well, Eritrea, you know, that bit.
Yeah.
Yeah. But the British got there first and got thwarted by the Italians. You know, there was a live, active kind of exploitation going on and colonization of the whole of Africa.
Absolutely. You know? I mean, that's why I began with the question of the global position of the UK in the scramble for Africa. You're absolutely right. I don't think we're disagreeing. I think that there is some soul searching to be done about, you know, the purposes of this kind of display and so on in the colonial context. Absolutely. But, you know, our project is led by Somalis who want to tell the story of their communities. So that's where we are. But thank you. Thank you for that reflection.
Thank you for this beautiful presentation, first of all.
Thank you.
I'm curious if you also looked at other villages or other expositions of peoples in other big cities in Europe and how their stories, because they're from other countries, they were not only Somali people being displayed, and how their stories correlate or not, or because I've never heard this narrative of these people being paid. I really always thought it was them being exploited without any compensation at all. Mm-hmm. And I also didn't understand or didn't have an understanding how they were brought here. So I thought they were like product of the colonization or, you know, like kind of taken away from their villages.
Yeah.
So can you tell us a little bit more about other stories and how those relate to these people or not?
Fantastic. Thank you so much. Great question. So, yeah, this was part one story, one very local and global story of what happened in Bradford, which is part of a much bigger picture of colonized people being brought to the West in these villages. We would like to connect our story with many other stories. There has been extensive research on ethnographic villages, on colonial displays. For example, Sadia Qureshi's book, People's on Parade. And there was a documentary on Channel 4 recently called The Human Zoo by Nadifa Muhammad, a Somali novelist. And so, Human Zoo is a framing I and my Somali partners resist for the reasons I put forward earlier, which is that it's not a one-sided interaction, it's a two-sided interaction that's important to acknowledge. But yes, we would love to connect this project with other stories of travel for the purposes of displaying one's culture in the colonial context. And everything that implies, it implies many difficult and uncomfortable things. And the story of colonization has not ended because, of course, it has impacts on how communities see their identity or their histories today. So we would love to connect it with larger arguments and research around the, let's say, afterlives of these villages and so on. And that is part of our project. This project is in its infancy, so that's where we are now. We're beginning with the local story. We're beginning with Halima, we're beginning with these 57 people, we're beginning with the 1904 exhibition in Lister Park and so on. But from there, we hope to connect with other stories of villages like it, not just Somalis. We have researchers in Chicago and in Germany and in Sweden who are helping us to put together a more global picture. But thank you, that's a really good reflection. Appreciate it. Any other questions?
Sorry, it's me again, but this is on a completely... Can you hear me all right?
Yeah.
On a completely different note, you mentioned that there had been other exhibition villages and things like that. Actually, I just remembered as you were talking that Bradford actually hosted two villages in the mid-1990s. I think it was in 94 and 95 or 96. We had a Pakistan music village came to Bradford as part of the Bradford Mela. And then the following year, a Moroccan music village, all in response to a demand that there was more Muslim programming as opposed to the Mela having lots of Bhangra and all of that. Yeah. Anyway, yeah. So anyway, I mean, I won't dominate the microphone any more than that.
Thank you for that.
There has been contemporary issues. Yeah.
Yeah. So the Mela is very interesting because it's another kind of festival, another kind of exhibition, and also connected to Lister Park. So there's a whole history you can tell of exhibitions and festivals in that Manningham area. And there was in 1902, so there was a Savage South Africa show in Manningham in a playing field, which was a reenactment of the Boer War. So the Somali village was not the first kind of display in Bradford, or in Manningham, we should say. And of course, what you just pointed out, the villages that also took place in the 90s, you could say these are afterlives of the same kind of thinking in many ways. So it would be great to connect these stories up. Thank you. Yeah.
Hiya. Thanks very much for the talk. I wondered if it was known whether the charge for photos was a kind of official thing that they was part of the contract, if you like, or whether it was a bit of a side gig for self-organized charge.
Thank you. So there were official photographs taken of the village that were staged, you know, the Sultan and his warriors in their ceremonial dress, you know, staged tableaus of their spear fighting, women at work and so on. They were taken by Rosemont Studios. They became part of the memorabilia of the exhibition. So when these exhibitions took place, the idea was that they would only be there temporarily. So that made the photography and the memorabilia really important because the exhibits would be there 1 month and gone the next and erased. You know, there'd be nothing left. So the memorabilia became really important as money spinners for the exhibition managers. The photographs of the Somali village, there were two kinds: the staged exhibitions taken formally and sold in the kiosks, and there were photos that individual visitors could take of the village, but they would pay the villagers individually for those photographs. And so there were two modes of photography. And One of the things that I wanted to point out, and kind of like you reminded me, thank you, is to see the differences between the staged and unstaged photos. Because I'm going to take you back to the first slide, my opening slide, because you see a slight contrast between seeing kids. So look, if you see, look at this picture. This is a staged photo of the kids, the Somali kids in Bradford. You know it's Bradford because you can see the railway behind. Okay, they've kind of got a flattened area, which we look for it. It doesn't look quite like that anymore. It's kind of overgrown in the park. But here you see, it's a kind of a tableau, you know, the way they're posing with their spears. This is the same group in the same place, maybe a few seconds before or after. It is an official photo, but you see them much more joyful, you know. And amongst the photographic archive of staged versus unstaged photos, you see glimpses into how these Somalis were living more authentically in the unstaged photo. Sometimes it's disturbing because you see the great and the good of Bradford gawping at them, and it's uncomfortable. At the same time, you see sometimes women with beaming smiles interacting with each other quite naturally, and you sort of think, well, they obviously saw the white folks looking at them as kind of thinking, well, they're crazy for wanting to pay money to see us. You can see that there are other ways to think about the interactions. And the photographic archive, I think, is quite revealing. It's not the only thing we have. We want to go back to the oral poetry and so on, but it's a big part of how we understand what was happening at this time. I'm sorry about this noise. It's kind of... it's a wind, yes.
I wondered if you knew, if people stayed in the village or if they had time off and went and pottered around Bradford and...
yeah.
I don't know, and brilliant. If they did their own bit of tourism. Yeah.
Thank you. So they had hours of service, of being on, being at work, and it was a number of hours a day, long hours, because the exhibition wanted to make as much money out of them as possible. That's part of the exploitation. But they did have time off. They would sometimes be taken out to do excursions and have dinner with the dignitaries of Bradford. I would say that when the park closed, when the exhibition closed for business, the villagers could stand down and relax. But it was grueling work because you had to be kind of there performing on display for long hours. But there was time, there was downtime as well. Yeah.
Just a quick question. I just wondered, I don't know if I didn't hear it at the beginning, but why was Bradford chosen as a location?
Right. So Bradford was the home of a great deal of industry. It was called Worcesterpolis, or the home of the wool trade in the north, and it had so. At the time, it was way ahead of nearby cities in terms of its industrial infrastructure, and it was a great global city. So the Great Exhibition, of which the Somali village was a part, was a way to show off Bradford's kind of technology and its kind of business forwardness. But as we heard from Christopher Gaffney on Tuesday, this was also the beginning of the decline of Bradford. So the village is part of the exhibition, which happens at a time when actually Bradford's past its best. But the reason why Bradford is chosen is because of its prominence as a centre for trade, a centre for industry, and of course the wool trade. Now, what's interesting is there's another whole story of the wool, of the textile trade, because the Somalis brought weaving expertise with them. And so one of the threads we want to kind of uncover is how their textile industry, trade, know-how, expertise, and knowledge systems kind of is a counterpart, a counter-narrative to the story of Bradford as Worcesterpolis. That's one of the stories we want to tell. I think there's a question at the front here.
Thank you for your patience. My question was, quite obviously a lot of these people were quite young as well who attended. Were any of them inclined to want to stay in UK and develop relationships, or were they strictly controlled? And also I wanted to ask you, was there any agenda by Christian missionaries to make them convert to Christianity as well?
Really good questions. So they were not allowed to stay. Their contracts did not allow them to stay on. We know that one person from our village, if I can call it that, did stay behind, ended up in London, and had a daughter who lives in Bradford. And we know the name, but we haven't been able to get in touch with the daughter to have a conversation about their history. But it was generally not allowed for them to stay longer. This was strictly a business transaction. It wasn't a route to migration. Unlike the seamen, who came to Cardiff and other port cities, they did come and live and stayed longer, but they were also controlled. They were not allowed to live wherever they wanted. They had to live in the city in which they were working in the docks. It was highly controlled. In terms of conversion to Christianity, not really. The Yorkshire Press describes a kind of looking down on them, but also sometimes admiration for them, for their different ritual practices. And what was interesting is you see a reverse missionizing, because when the imam gives his Friday sermon, you can see he's speaking to the general public, not to his community. He's saying quite basic things. And one of the sermons in the early part of the village's presence in Bradford is translated in the Yorkshire Press into English, and the Arabic's transliterated badly, but the translation shows you that this was a way to show off Islam to the Bradford visiting public. So I would say that it's probably the other way around. They're doing da'wah, if you like, or missionizing. Yeah, thank you.
When the Somalians first came to Bradford, did they like volunteer, or were they brought here by like Europeans?
Right, thank you. So what we know about this group of 57 is that they were contracted because Sultan Ali, their troop leader, and also plan leader, you know, that's how he's portrayed, he brought this group together for Victor Bamberger, the European showrunner. So in that sense, it was voluntary. Now, when we say voluntary, we have to nuance it, because what's the context? The context is Britain is fighting a war in Somaliland, okay? There's a colonial context. Colonialism, as we know, is exploitative. Somalis are probably living a very precarious life. They need ways to earn a living. They are nomadic. They have livestock. Traveling abroad is a way to earn money to buy more livestock at home. So yes, it's voluntary, but the context is that they are probably being pushed to the edge of existence by the fact of this colonial kind of incursion into their land. So it's voluntary, but we know there's a bigger context, which is a pressure on them. Does that answer the question? Okay.
Hello. It is a bigger pressure, because you said they earn sort 7 to 12 pounds or something like that. You also said that they lost 200 to 300 pounds in the fire, so they didn't make anything, it seems.
The person who lost the most in the fire was Sultan Ali, the troop leader. And the most of the valuables of the village were stored in two of the huts that burnt down. So they did incur a great loss. I think it's a good point. Did they even make any money out of it? We were told that they took some of the materials from the huts that they brought with them back with them to sell again or to use again. There's a whole story of the kind of economics and the materials aspect of this village and its dismantling and kind of its onward travels, which we'd love to know more about. We know they were shrewd business people, and so nothing would have gone unnoticed or overlooked. That's part of the kind of story we're trying to uncover, is did they actually get anything out of it financially? And it is a question whether they did or not. Probably the person with the most to lose was the Sultan, and he indeed did lose a lot. Yeah, so the compensation he received was paltry compared to what he lost. But thank you for that. Okay, I think we'll leave it there. Thank you so much for all your questions and for coming. Thank you.
Thank you for joining us for this episode of the Explore Words, Discover Worlds podcast, presented by Bradford Literature Festival. If you enjoyed this episode and you'd like to help support the podcast, please subscribe, share this episode with others, and leave a rating. Mark your calendars for the return of Bradford Literature Festival on Friday the 27th of June to Sunday the 6th of July 2025.